The reading today is on page 1153. It's from 1 Corinthians, and that's chapter 10, starting at verse 23. All things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbour. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, "This has been offered in sacrifice," then do not eat it, for the sake of the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I do not mean your conscience, but his. For why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offence to Jews or to Greeks or to the Church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, as I am of Christ.
Thank you, Charlotte. There's a diagram, actually, inside the service sheet you might want to grab hold of, where you can look at that. For 5 weeks, we've been looking at Christian decision-making, which sounds really dull, doesn't it? Aged 18, I spent 6 months on a committee trying to decide what colour the church door should be. And even in Somerset villages, there were other things for 18-year-olds to do than that. It sounds dull, but it affects everything. Maybe you're deciding whether to become a Christian or not. Well, will I be free? Yes. Yes, you will. What does freedom look like? Well, it looks like giving up everything for the sake of other people. For Christians, this governs everything, how much we can be involved in the world around us. It governs when we've gone from harmless freedom through to dangerous idolatry. And we've been in a five-week series, and Paul summarizes the whole three chapters in four verses from verse 31 on page 1153. And it's really very easy, Christian decision-making. There are two steps. Step one, verse 31, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So when you're faced with a decision, and you could do A, B, or C, it's simple. You do the one that glorifies God. Then step two, maybe you still have options A or C left, you run them past the second step, verse 32. You consider everyone else who might be involved or might be watching, and verse 33, you put their advantage ahead of your own in everything. So it's really quite simple, isn't it? It's even easy to remember. It paraphrases the most famous thing that Jesus ever said. Love God and love your neighbour. Paul says the same. Whatever you do, glorify God and put other people first. Which you'd think would just about wrap up Christian decision making. Those of you who left the rugby to be here, you'll think that's slightly cheated. Except that these four verses come at the end of three chapters where Paul has sweated his way through a minefield of tricky issues. Locally, we've said the issue is, what food can you eat? Most of the meat in the town only gets to the supermarket via a temple. So the complex decision is, when can we eat the meat and when can't we? People are confused. Some people think the idols in the temples are so bad that you shouldn't touch any meat that's been near them. Then others think they have freedom to do whatever they want, whatever idol worshippers do, as long as they mutter under their breath, there's no such thing as other gods. Hugely complex for them. But then, real decisions normally are. The two steps may be easy, but putting them into practice isn't. So we're going to work through the advice to Corinth, and then we'll try the same principles on some current issues for us. In fact, some people have emailed in current issues, and we will try and work through some of those, and then there'll be question time, as Kev said, and we'll have a go at them. So that means we're trying to do all three chapters tonight, not just the verses that we read. And on the handout, I've had a go at a flowchart. I know some people will really like that, and others will have the allergic reaction beginning already. So it's not meant to pretend these questions are easy, that there are just three yes-no questions and you're done. But it's to help us to see what we need to decide, what we need to think about as we make decisions. So let's start with step one on the flowchart. Last week we applied that. Glorify God in everything, which meant in Corinth, question one, is it participation in idolatry? So if they're in the temple while the gods are being worshipped and they're joining in, then verse 20 of chapter 10 says they are participating with demons. And that is not glorifying God, and they need to flee. He has specifically religious ceremonies in mind. The pagan equivalent of the Lord's Supper. You're at the sacrifice to Zeus, at the table of Zeus, and drinking the cup with Zeus. So don't do it. It's the equivalent of when your friend invites you to their wedding and to the Hindu religious ceremony that goes with it. If you join in, you're participating. You can't do it. But he clearly expects them to be able to answer no to that question in lots and lots of cases. So the verses we read tonight, verses 25 to 30, they wind up the whole argument by saying some things you can do. Verse 25, you can eat whatever meat you find in the market, even if there's a good chance it started life or actually started its death, tied to an altar by a big bearded priest of Zeus. If you buy it as a goat burger in the market, you are not participating in Zeus worship. You're just boosting your cholesterol. Verse 27 as well, if a pagan friend invites you to dinner, same thing. You go along and you eat. You don't send him the sort of picky Christian list of foods you won't touch beforehand. Just eat the food. Don't insist on a certified, idolatry-free trail of production. Eat the meat. He even goes so far in chapter 8 as saying you can eat in the idol's temple. So look back at chapter 8, verse 9. He talks about this right of yours. You have the right. And in verse 10, it's clear he means this right to eat in an idol's temple. Now, it might be very hard for us to imagine a non-participation reason to just drop round the temple of Diana. But Paul thinks there could be. And archaeologists, when they're working it out, they reckon that he means eating in the big dining rooms that existed in the temple. So you had the sort of temple bit upstairs, and then you had private dining rooms downstairs that you could hire out. You could hire them the same way you'd hire out a pub today. You could host a party or a work reception in them. And eating there, even in the temple building, need not mean participation. Depends what they do while you're there. So question one, participation. You give a yes or a no, but saying no doesn't necessarily mean you're okay to eat. Question one just does our step one, glorify God. All the other steps are about putting other people first. And we've said all along that it calls for some hard questions, this, about what kind of Christian you are. Are you in it for what is in it for you? Or are you in it for Jesus and for other people? I read a controversial article recently titled Why Evangelicals Hate Jesus. It's really about politics. It comes from a certain political point of view, whether Jesus would have voted a certain way. But how about this for a scathing paragraph? Evangelicals don't exactly hate Jesus. They do love him dearly, but not because of what he tried to teach humanity. Rather, evangelicals love Jesus for what he does for them. Through his magical grace and by shedding his precious blood, Jesus saves evangelicals from everlasting torture in hell and guarantees them a premium luxury villa in heaven. For this, and this only, they love him. They can't stop thanking him. And yet, as for Jesus himself, most evangelicals seem to have nothing but disdain. What do we think as an evangelical church, what we make of that paragraph? Often it is the unfair, nasty outside criticisms that put their finger on something true and uncomfortable. Jesus says, put others first. Our step two tonight, love your neighbour as yourself. But most of us lose our teeth when Paul says something like 8 verse 13. If food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat. Can we really say we live by 10 verse 33? That we live to get others saved, not just to enjoy the benefits of being saved ourselves? So as we work through the next steps on the flowcharts, what kind of Christian are you? Are you in it for yourself, or are you in it for other people? So the second question, which came in verse 8 of chapter 8, is would it destroy the weak? So look at 8 verse 9 again. You have the right to eat in the temple dining rooms, but with that right comes the responsibility to take care. Take care that I don't harm other Christians as I use my free right. His example is the person in verse 7. The person in verse 7 of chapter 8, they have a former association with idols, which means they couldn't do what you do without sinning. If they walk back into Diana's temple, where they were once so devoted, even if it's a normal meal, not a religious one, in their hearts they would be going back in time to before their conversion, and they would be worshipping Diana. Verse 7, they would eat food as defiled. So take care. And if your action could affect them, better not to eat meat at all ever again, which is a way of saying you need to do whatever it would take not to hurt them. So here's an example, not a particularly good example, but I remember driving in convoy behind an older, wiser Christian. I'd been recently been kind of challenged that driving recklessly was wrong, and I was trying to fight the temptation. I followed his car for no more than half an hour, and in general, he drove carefully and within the law. But there was one glorious bit of road down an open hillside in the Lake District where he cut loose and put his foot down. I doubt he really even realised that he had. After a short battle with my weak conscience, I put my foot down on my considerably less safe and faster car, and I matched him turn for turn. It's a bad example because you could argue he was sinning, actually, because for small sections he'd been over the speed limit. But the effect on me was exactly chapter 8. This was the rebirth of the boy racer from the Somerset Lanes. That half hour changed my driving for 10 years. It took increasing old age, police intervention, and government re-education to make a change back again. What you do can be very powerful. But several people have emailed in to ask what counts as, or who counts as, a weaker brother? Or even what happens if you have two weaker brothers asking for slightly different things? And I think 8 verse 7 helps a lot. The weaker brother or sister needs to have a genuine reason why this is an issue for them. So some, through former association with idols, you can't win any discussion at church by playing the weaker brother card. Oh, do I not like the time of the service? Weaker brother, you must have it when I want. Many of the issues that are used as weaker brother issues actually get their force not from a past non-Christian association in the culture, but because of a Christian culture that someone grew up in. So, for example, if playing cards is hard for you because you were once an addict to gambling, then I will put them away. But if you've never played cards because you've always thought they were wrong, then I'm less sure if I need to. That the key issue is whether what I do will actually harm you or not. Will you see me doing something and be encouraged to do the same, but for you it will be eating as that really offered to an idol? So it's not enough to say that playing cards is against my conscience. I need to know several other things. I need to know that if you see me playing cards, you will genuinely start playing cards, rather than just stand saying, oh, you bad Christian because you play cards. And I need to know that if you did, you would think it was sin, and it will help me understand massively if you can show me the thing in your past that means you associate playing cards with sin. Does that help? In fact, Colossians 2 verse 16, you might want to write down. That's the place to start reading if you find yourself on the other side of the coin. In Colossians, you don't have the weaker brother, but the judgmental brother. If my playing cards is no problem to you spiritually, but you want me to stop so you can judge me, well then respectfully I can say no. I might still try and arrange things so that it causes as least trouble in the church as possible. We won't have maybe a whist drive to raise money in this church if you have that issue. But I won't need to follow the rule that you strike for me. One of the questions that came in actually pointed out that you could end up keeping so many rules for the sake of the weaker brother that you end up damaging a whole different group of people. That you end up implying actually you're only a real Christian if you keep these rules. You only should be a Christian if you can be good enough to live your life this way. Where if they're not actually Jesus' rules, they're not actually Bible rules, you've created a stumbling block the whole different way. Now, I think that is fair, but here is the caution. If in doubt, be prepared to put another person first, no matter what it costs you. So if your real reason is just you love playing cards, then I'd be very cautious. All of us keep a very clever barrister in our heads who is permanently on standby to wade in whenever I want to argue that I could do whatever I enjoy doing. 11 verse 1 says the example is Jesus Christ, willing to give up his own advantages, including heaven, and seek the salvation of many, including me, even if it costs his death. So, back on the flowcharts, we've said it's not participation, and it's not harming a weaker brother. So we get to the third box, and 10 verse 25 says you can eat without raising any questions. And that is actually a very radical statement from Paul. We miss it, I think, because we're so used to freedom. It's different to how you would have lived as a Pharisee, and it's different from how lots and lots of Christians live. If there's nothing there to make you think you shouldn't do it, then you can. You don't need to go down the market store saying, were these sausages offered to the great god of entrails? You don't have to kind of ask about everyone. If it doesn't say, you can assume it's okay to eat. And there's a structure to 25 to 30. It goes permission, reason. Permission, reason, twice. So you can eat anything from the meat market because, verse 26, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So every bit of whatever weird food you like, pulverized snail's toenail or whatever, if you find it on the stall, it belongs to God. He created it, not Zeus. He owns it, not Hermes. So you can eat it. The structure then looks a bit complicated because Paul has slipped one last exception, verse 28 in between the permission and the reason. So verse 29. Reason for, why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? That is a reason to eat. It's the reason for verse 27. It's not the reason not to eat, like in verse 28. So is that too complicated? Look it down. So the structure is verse 27, yes you can. Verse 29 and 30, here's the reason why. Verse 28, here's one more exception. So you can eat without asking questions because the conscience you're responsible for is your own, not other people's. It's the positive side of chapter 8. Some things are wrong, but extra things can be wrong for you if your conscience thinks they're wrong. So if you think that playing cards is wrong, doesn't matter whether it actually is or not, for you, you think God says don't do it. So if I sit down and play cards and I think it's okay, all I'm doing is playing cards. If you sit down and play cards, you in your head have got to deliberately say, God, I don't care what you think, I'm going to disobey your rule that I think you've laid down, and I'm going to play cards because I want to. Does that make sense? Your conscience actually makes it wrong for you. But that only applies to your own conscience. It doesn't make it sin for me because you think so. I can play cards with thankfulness. It's actually a really good test of where your conscience is. Again, it's not a universal test for what's right and wrong. If your conscience says murder is okay, doesn't make it fine. But if you can give thanks for something, then probably your conscience is okay with it. So if you can bow your head before God and thank God for the film you're about to see or the magazine you're about to buy, then that suggests your conscience at least is clear on it. So I eat with thankfulness until somebody intervenes, verse 28, and they tell me this has been offered in sacrifice. And Paul is really clear that that makes a change. But it doesn't leap us right up to the top of the diagram, Because the person says this has been in the past offered in sacrifice doesn't mean you're now participating in idolatry and demons. The food is still okay. You're still well outside of a participation situation. But you do now have somebody else's conscience to consider, because they have told you what they think. They've told you what's going on. Paul doesn't specify who they are. They might be a Christian. They might be a pagan. It doesn't matter. They've made a connection between what you're doing and the worship of idols. So for them, if you keep eating, you are joining in. So verse 28, do not eat it for the sake of the one who informed you. But poor Christian, if they finally manage to make it all the way through the flowchart and nobody said anything, finally you're allowed to get to the box at the bottom and tuck in. So you'd be pretty hungry by then. Does that make sense? That's roughly how it would have applied in Corinth. I hope that's reasonably clear in their situation. But if you'll bear with me, I want to do it all again now with some of the tricky situations that people sent in, the present day examples. Please can I say, we are not trying now to lay down new laws. Look, now that Charlie has spoken, you'll know what to do. What I'm trying to do is show you how these might apply so that we get the principles under our skin and begin applying them ourselves. So, for example, let's start with, quite a few people have asked me about halal food. So halal meat, to be halal meat, an animal has to be killed in a certain way, and it has to have a short prayer said to Allah as it dies. So some Christians have said that that meat has therefore been offered to a false god. So let's run the flowchart. Question one, are you participating in worship? I'd say no. You're not in the mosque, and you aren't praying or bowing down or joining in any worship. Question two, would it destroy the weak? Well, only if you have a group of ex-Muslim friends who have become Christians, and only if those friends, when they were Muslims, thought that eating halal food was an act of worship, and if they decided once they were Christians never to eat halal again, and if they would genuinely be encouraged to eat if they saw you eat. It's possible, but I think it's unlikely. Then question three, has somebody told you? And there it depends what they're telling you as well. So I don't think a halal sticker on a packet of chicken counts as verse 28. I've asked people I know who have lots of dealings with Muslim friends. I've actually tracked down one of the Muslim chaplains at one of the London universities, asked him as well. And they don't see the prayer over halal food as an offering to gods. The closest parallel seems to be to saying grace before a Christian meal. So a Muslim has addressed his gods about the chicken, but nobody has offered the chicken as a sacrifice. I think that means you would need a very, very specific situation to turn down halal food. I think maybe if you were from a Muslim family and your family thought that if they could get you eating halal food, that would mean you were a Muslim again. So maybe they serve you a non-halal starter, no problem, and then they ambush you with a halal main course. And once you're tucking in, they announce, aha, that was halal, so you're a Muslim again. In which case, you would be right to stop eating and put them right. But I think normally, there would be lots and lots of reasons from these chapters to eat halal foods. 10 verse 33 says, we seek the advantage of many, that they may be saved. At the end of chapter 9 talks about adjusting your habits so that you become all things to all men, 9 verse 22. So if eating and serving halal food will make it at all easier to speak about Jesus, then do it. Even with sort of friends, family, whoever it is, even with people who maybe knew that you've changed from being a Muslim to a Christian, still it might be right to eat halal food with them so the conversation can go on. Let's try another example. A couple of people emailed in asking about football matches or about going to a gig. So if I go to a gig of my favourite band, where there are people waving their arms around because they adore or worship or live for that band, what do you do? Well, clearly I've been going to the wrong gigs. Let's follow it through. So participation. Well, only if you are worshipping too. Now, just pause there. I have known Christian football fans and also music fans who were worshipping, I think. If the glory of Arsenal comes ahead of the glory of God, even after last night, then flee from it. And I think the sort of questions are, who wins when there are decisions about time and money and you have to choose God or football, let's say? Bible study weekend away with Euston Church or away football fixture. Which one's going to win? Money to go to gospel work that you care about or season tickets? Or time with Christians or time hanging around hoping to touch Justin Bieber's French? Whatever it would be. Again, not wrong, but if... apparently there it is in the room. But if it has become the life-directing goal for you, and I've known people where it has, then maybe question one. Question two, destroying the week. Well, occasionally Christians have thought it was wrong to go to music venues, so that is a possibility. But I think the third question is more likely. If you're with a group of people who inappropriately idolise something, and that it becomes apparent that they think you're involved in that, they think you're putting the gig or the football where God should be, if they're worshipping, they turn and make it clear to you that they think you are as well, then that would be the time to find a way to make it clear that you're not, and to leave. So maybe by changing your being there but changing your behaviour, or just not going once, to show that you can break the habit, you don't have to go to every game, or whatever it would be. Third example, how about a more directly religious example? So somebody asked about yoga. Can you do the stretches and the fitness without being involved in the Eastern religion that lies about behind it? Or a similar example, my manager at a Christian charity I work for asked me, can we offer acupuncture to our clients? So question one, is it participation in idolatry? Well, I think not necessarily. So non-religious GPs use acupuncture and believe it to be just sticking needles in you. So all I'm doing is making holes in you. But they can measure a certain clinical effectiveness, so they do it, without necessarily knowing quite why it works scientifically, or without buying into any of the religious explanations. Same with yoga. Stretching is stretching. Twisting your leg over your head sounds like unfitness to me, but there is nothing definitively religious about it. So that's question one. But we decided not to allow acupuncture on our premises on the basis of question two. See, there were enough people around who thought that you were using spiritual energy to heal people. So to have acupuncture offered in a Christian building might encourage them back into wrong ideas. So similarly with yoga, you might need to be very careful who you tell that that's what you're doing or who you go with. And I think the key question will be question three. So when my manager asked the acupuncturist, do you think there's any religious element to what you're doing? They said no. So she decided it was okay to allow our clients to refer themselves for acupuncture and to kind of support them as they did that. So it depends on your yoga teacher. If your yoga teacher or the class, if it makes no mention of spiritual elements, then I think there is no need to raise questions of conscience. Go distort your body with thankfulness. But if somebody says, we're now worshipping, or somebody says, I find it so powerful saluting the sun with you, then you need to stop, disentangle yourself, and leave for the sake of their conscience, not yours. So there's a few examples. Those last four particularly, the footy, the gig, the fitness, and the acupuncture, there may be good reasons actually to do them, to throw yourself wholeheartedly into them. See, Paul behaves like a Jew when he's trying to win Jews. He won't do anything to offend them, but he will live like them. Same applies when he's trying to win Greeks. So the aim is their advantage and their salvation. If you're trying to win football fans, live like a football fan. Become like one. I want to just finish by looking at chapter 11, verse 1. The big picture is live for God and live for others. And 11 verse 1 takes us to Jesus Christ and does so right along with the main point of the letter. The main point of the whole letter is to puncture pride. 8 verse 1 said their knowledge of their freedoms was puffing them up. They're enjoying how free they are. They say, we can eat in the temple dining rooms because we don't have the hang-ups of the little people. And we're this new super breed of free Christians. It's easy to think that way about past Christian generations with their rules about what you can drink and what you can do and what you can watch. Well, Paul has just given them three chapters of the decision-making heart of Jesus. God's glory first, other people second, my advantage and my freedom last. Which is designed to reveal areas where I'm not living like that. And other areas where it just sounds too hard to do. It sounds like I will miss out on lots of life. 11 verse 1 takes those concerns and says, look at Jesus. Look at his example. Look at the way he lived and admire him. How beautiful, how excellent his life was. Are you encouraged to imitate it? He applied step one, even when the thing that brought glory to God was his own death. He applied step two through hatred and flogging and spitting and death. And all the while he was seeking the advantage of the people on the other end of the whips and the cruel words. As he died, they said, if you're the Christ, save yourself and us. And if he had been less gracious, he might have replied, which do you want of those two things? Because I am the Christ, I choose not to save myself so that I can save you. It's one of the most ironic things ever said. Save yourself and us. He has to choose one or the other, and he chose us. Which humbles puffed up pride, doesn't it? But it is also the total sufficient answer to any sin that this exercise has revealed. Maybe you have been participating in wrong worship. Maybe you have been ignoring the weak and the consciences of others. Well, yes, take the decision seriously. Yes, be single-minded about them. But there is forgiveness for all of our wrong decisions. Jesus' death is both example and the place where the responsibility for my bad decisions, no matter how willful or sinful or even demonic, is taken off my shoulders and placed on his. So we should take the apparent simplicity of this advice here with confident smiles. It can be applied even in our complex lives because Jesus did, Paul has showed us how, and marvellously there is forgiveness for every single failed decision. I'm going to pray and then we'll move towards question time. Father God, praise you for Jesus, that though he was rich, he became poor, that he could save us. Lord, please give us that heart to seek the advantage of others, even where we'd have to give up things we enjoy, even where we'd have to curtail our freedom. Lord, would we do it for the sake of others, that they'd be saved, that they'd be kept, and would we do it for your glory? Please help us. In Jesus' name, amen.